Chapter 36 The Bravest Battle. In August 1873, Grant's new Treasury Secretary, William A. Richardson, a Harvard-educated lawyer from Lowell, Massachusetts, who had replaced Boutwell, contemplated the American economy with unruffled satisfaction. "I have devoted considerable time this summer to the investigation of the condition of the commerce of the country, and am very much pleased at the favorable exhibit." To buttress his rosy appraisal, he cited mounting exports in cotton, bread, iron, steel, leather, and shoes. The government boasted a small surplus and had refinanced outstanding debt at reduced interest rates. In short, the boom that had powered the post-war economy appeared intact. Modern mass industries such as steel and petroleum and ever-expanding railroads had introduced new vigor but also instability into the economy. Only in retrospect would it be clear that the boom had been built on a flimsy scaffolding of speculation and that excessively generous credit had overextended the nation's railways. On September 8th, Wall Street banks started to fold in a cascading series of closures that sparked chaos in the financial district. Gold prices dove, stocks collapsed, and a general panic seized the city. Coincidentally, Grant found himself with a front-row seat for the foremost bankruptcy. He had gone to place Jesse in Cheltenham Academy outside Philadelphia and stayed at Ogontz, the estate of J. Cook, whose firm had marketed Union bonds during the war and bankrolled the Northern Pacific Railway. Grant and Elihu Washburn had even made stock investments through him. Ogontz was a gloomy five-story pile smothered in heavy Victorian furniture, but Cook, with his long patriarchal beard, proved a warm and charming host. On the morning of September 18th, as Grant got ready to leave for Washington, Cook pocketed several ominous telegrams, giving Grant no hint of their contents. It turned out that J. Cook and Company, unable to sell Northern Pacific bonds, had gone bust. Such was the firm's incomparable prestige that its failure fanned a jittery situation into a full-blown panic, toppling one Wall Street house after another. On September 20th, the New York Stock Exchange halted trading for 10 days. Grant received emergency pleas for purchases of treasury bonds to add liquidity to national banks, while Thomas Murphy, the former New York customs collector, wired, "Relief must come immediately, or hundreds, if not thousands, of our best men will be ruined." Not since 1837 had such a spasm of fear flashed through Wall Street. In this heyday of laissez-faire economics, citizens didn't automatically expect the president to manage the economy or cushion downturns. Economic fluctuations were regarded almost like vagaries of weather. Nevertheless, on September 20th, Grant and Richardson journeyed to New York, staying at the Fifth Avenue Hotel, where desperate businessmen besieged them. As Harper's Weekly described the scene, "The corridors swarmed with a multitude of frenzied people who supposed that incalculable disaster impended and that the president had the power of staying it by a word." Any credit breakdown, Grant knew, would threaten produce shipped to the eastern seaboard for export, and he feared the crisis would soon migrate from Wall Street to Main Street. At the behest of New York bankers, he agreed to purchase treasury bonds, but in the absence of a central bank, the government couldn't function as a lender of last resort, and he balked at more stimulative measures. As he put it, the government would take all legal measures at its command, but it is evident that no government efforts will avail without the active cooperation of the banks and moneyed corporations. Boldly deviating from precedent, Grant allowed Richardson to reissue $26 million worth of greenbacks to satisfy those who thought some measure of inflation might revive the economy. In an interview, Grant sought to soothe the nation, describing the panic as a passing event. Writing privately to the banker Anthony J. Drexel, he sounded equally sanguine. "I hope the worst of the panic is over and that general good may flow from it." Far from being transitory, the crisis was deep and intractable, and persisted for more than 5 brutal years. It would be termed the Great Depression, until eclipsed by the 1930s downturn. Much of the industrial landscape lay in ruins. Half the nation's railroads went into receivership, and half its iron furnaces shut down. In farming areas, crop and land prices plunged. In New York City alone, a quarter of all workers were tossed from their jobs. Before the Depression ran its course, deflation had dragged down wholesale prices by 30%. Industrial leaders banded together to cut production and stabilize prices, leading to monopolistic practices in many industries and spawning a corresponding concentration in labor. Many workers joined unions that engaged in railway, textile, and coal strikes and flirted with radical movements. For the first time, America began to resemble the stratified, class-ridden societies of Europe. As unions demanded public works projects and easy money, Grant had to deal with a constellation of political forces unknown to earlier presidents in a simpler agrarian America. No clear theory dictated how government should steer the economy through such a profound downturn. I look on the coming session of Congress as the most troublesome and uncertain of any that I have ever seen at this distance from it, Garfield wrote that November. The great financial panic which has swept and is still sweeping over the country will be the most difficult element to handle. The business community favored a cleansing of speculative excess by clinging to a tight money policy, forcing prices and wages to drop. Within Grant's cabinet, Hamilton Fish argued forcefully for austerity. Any expansion would only bolster up some now tottering concerns and would encourage new speculations. Garfield and Richardson talked Grant out of an ambitious and far-sighted plan to combat unemployment through a large-scale public works project, which would have anticipated Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. As president, Grant had taken pride in being a scrupulous custodian of the nation's finances, cutting taxes, reducing expenditures, saving money on interest payments, and working toward restoring gold as the currency basis. The panic of 1873 gave fresh urgency to the question of what to do about the circulation of greenbacks, which had helped the North to finance the Civil War and taken the country off the gold standard. Traditionally, Americans had harbored deep suspicion of paper money, which wasn't backed by gold reserves. Yet greenbacks were championed by Western farmers and railroads who had borrowed heavily and therefore favored expansionary monetary policy. In contrast, bankers and other Eastern creditors wanted Grant to resume the gold standard, giving money an imperishable value, a course backed by Lincoln, who had called for a return to specie payments at the earliest period compatible with due regard to all interests concerned. In general, Grant deemed it one of the highest duties of government to secure to the citizen a medium of exchange of fixed, unvarying value. At the same time, he feared a tight money supply might impose a straitjacket on the economy. He held surprisingly modern views on the need for an elastic currency that would expand and contract with seasonal trade. On the other hand, when surplus funds existed, he didn't want excess money to flow into speculative Wall Street loans and stock market gambling. The seemingly esoteric topic of greenbacks became one of the most fraught issues of Grant's second term. By early 1874, the unemployed surged into the streets in mass protests, and they wanted more money in circulation to prime the economic pump. When Grant took office, there were $356 million in greenbacks in circulation, with Boutwell and Richardson adding small amounts to that sum. Any further moves in that direction raised the specter of inflation, eliciting strident protests from hard money men. "Now that no war threatens us and no overmastering necessity is to be pleaded," proclaimed Roscoe Conkling, "guilty and mad will be the hour when Congress can find no better way to conduct the finances of the nation than to print an unlimited issue of irredeemable promises to pay." Nevertheless, the House and Senate rushed through legislation to boost the greenback currency to $400 million and the national banknote circulation to $400 million. a sharp increase in the nation's money supply. By April 14th, this legislation, known as the Ferry Bill after its sponsor, Senator Thomas W. Ferry, but commonly dubbed the Inflation Bill, sat on Grant's desk with every expectation of his endorsement. As he considered the bill, he was being vilified for corruption and cozy ties to congressional bosses. "Discontent is everywhere," Vice President Wilson warned him. "We are passing through a storm of criticism and denunciation. You can carry us through the wilderness as you once did." Factory workers, farmers, and Westerners clamored for the inflation bill, but the nation deplored Senate complicity in the legislation, regretting how that body is given over completely to inflation in its maddest form. Reviewing the bill with painstaking care, Grant found himself in a terrible quandary. He knew more greenbacks would make it difficult to resume specie payments, that is, allow Americans to redeem paper currency for gold or silver. At the same time, the bill enjoyed widespread approval from his stalwart cronies in Congress, especially John Logan, Oliver Morton, and Ben Butler, plus members of his own cabinet. When it assembled on April 17th, all but two of his secretaries wanted him to put his signature to the bill. Grant sat, listened, and said nothing, a poker player refusing to tip his hand. That day, the Telegraph entrepreneur Cyrus Field bombarded him with a petition signed by 2,500 leading businessmen pleading for a veto of the bill. Grant replied that he had watched the progress of this bill through Congress with more interest than he had any other measure before that body since he had been president, but he still refused to commit himself. Albert Redstone, president of the National Labor Council, squeezed Grant from the other side, anxiously urging him to approve the inflation bill and telling a reporter that Grant will show that the people did not make him president to prevent their will and prevent their prosperity. Some Republican leaders conjured up visions of wholesale Western defections from the party because of a veto, a compelling argument for Grant and a frightening one. As he wrestled with a monetary riddle, he experienced such turmoil that he suffered bouts of insomnia. Even on blood-soaked battlefields, he had slept more soundly. On April 21st, Grant summoned his cabinet and made a startling confession. The night before, he had resolved to sign the inflation bill and sat up late drafting an accompanying message listing his most cogent arguments. But the more he wrote, he said, the more specious his own arguments sounded. "The only time I ever deliberately resolved to do an expedient thing for party reasons, against my own judgment, was on the occasion of the inflation bill," Grant confessed years later. "I never was so pressed in my life to do anything as to sign that bill, never." The more he wrote that night, the less he was persuaded by his own reasoning. Finally, he thought, "What is the good of all this? You do not believe it. You know it is not true." So he tore up his message, tossed it into the wastebasket, and decided to veto the bill. It was an impressive display of Grant's intellectual honesty, candor, and exemplary courage. He had examined the bill dispassionately from many angles and found it wanting. Grant refrained from asking for advice from his cabinet. Fish and Postmaster General Creswell applauded him. Fish said Grant had given America nothing less than the foundation of a restored credit and a sounder currency. But other cabinet secretaries fired back with a battery of protests. Secretary of the Interior Delano reminded Grant that vetoes were usually reserved for declaring acts unconstitutional. Secretary of the Navy Robeson predicted a detrimental outcome in upcoming congressional elections. Attorney General Williams and Secretary of War Belknap foresaw untold damage to the fortunes of the Republican Party. Yet unconditional surrender Grant proved adamant. "I dare say the first result will be a storm of denunciation," he admitted, "but I am confident that the final judgment of the country will approve my veto." Though Grant always viewed the inflation bill veto as a proud accomplishment, ushering in a new age of sound money, he braced for fierce attacks. Surprisingly enough, his veto was sufficiently popular, even in parts of the West, that opponents fell short of the votes needed to override it. Not surprisingly, bankers and businessmen flooded the White House with congratulatory telegrams. The attorney Edwards Pierpont wired from New York, "God Almighty bless you! The bravest battle and the greatest victory of your life!" Garfield hurried to the White House to offer up a whiff of incense. "For 20 years, no president has had an opportunity to do the country so much service by a veto message as Grant has," he wrote, "and he has met the issue manfully." Grant had made a timely statement about his integrity, and the malaise that infected the administration seemed to vanish overnight. "We shall be able to stick to Grant to the end," rejoiced Rutherford B. Hayes. The veto restored Grant's image as a simple, decent, straightforward president, every inch his own man. "He has a wonderful amount of good sense," Fish commented, "and when left alone, is very apt to follow it." If the veto solidified the Republican Party's growing reputation as a bastion of sound money, free markets, and economic conservatism, it did not sit well in all quarters. A meeting of Indianapolis merchants took Grant to task for having sold himself to those whose God is the dollar, and said it was utterly shameful that he should do their bidding. By the light of modern economic theory, it is hard to justify a veto that tightened money amid a severe economic contraction and likely worsened it. It also stoked populist movements, especially among Eastern immigrants and Western farmers, providing a major new opening for the Democrats in this era of Republican hegemony. But the veto did offer beneficial effects. It reassured European investors, who financed railroads and heavy industry, that they could plow funds into American business and be repaid in sound money. In this way, Grant's decision, which likely had severely deleterious effects on deflation in the short run, set the stage for America's emergence as the world's supreme industrial power. Not long after Grant's veto, Secretary of the Treasury Richardson left the cabinet, trailed by scandal. A Massachusetts politician, John D. Sanborn, had been hired by the Treasury Department to track down tax evaders and was allowed to retain half the back taxes collected. He extorted money from companies by falsely accusing them of tax evasion. Richardson had signed the contract with Sanborn and came in for sharp criticism. "Since I have been in Washington the past few days," Vice President Wilson notified Grant, "I have heard the strongest condemnation of Richardson's unfitness." In early June 1874, Grant banished Richardson by exiling him to the U.S. Court of Claims, a peculiar penalty for official misconduct, probably explained by the fact that Richardson hadn't profited from the transactions in question. Benjamin Bristow, the first Solicitor General and a spirited booster of Grant's inflation bill veto, was tapped as the new Treasury Secretary. With his upright reputation, Bristow seemed a superb choice. "Grant can do more unexpected things in the same length of time than any man I know," observed the diplomat Marshall Jewell. If Bristow claimed little financial expertise, he was honest and competent, hailed from a key border state, and had excelled in the Klan prosecutions. A tall, heavy-set man, he had an elegant appearance and a firm sweep of the jaw that one reporter predicted promised an aggressive performance at Treasury. Hamilton Fish came away pleased by their first cabinet meeting, lauding Bristow as masterful, energetic, and ambitious. A zealous advocate of civil service reform, Bristow soon expelled hundreds of political appointees from his department. As Grant reshuffled his cabinet, he replaced Postmaster General Creswell, who had done an excellent job, lobbying for a postal telegraph while incurring the wrath of the Western Union monopoly. He was succeeded by Marshall Jewell, a former Connecticut governor and minister to Russia. Like Bristow, Jewell had crusaded for civil service reform and immediately started cleaning up his department with Grant's blessing. The appointments of Bristow and Jewell were seen as triumphs of good government, and the Union League of America congratulated them for inaugurating a new and healthier order of things in their departments, ridding them of corrupt and inefficient officers. Their appointments formed part of Grant's rebuttal of liberal Republican critics who saw him as much too lax on scandal. Having killed the inflation bill, Grant completed his monetary program with a return to the gold standard, which would enable any citizen who walked into a Treasury office to exchange greenbacks for gold coins. The policy remained explosive amid a depression that many populists blamed on scarce money. After Grant outlined his views in a memorandum, House Speaker James G. Blaine cautioned Fish that, if carried out, it would be ruinous to the Republican Party and the country. Even hard money men worried about moving too quickly, arousing popular ire. Despite this, Bristow urged Congress to pass legislation to return the currency to a specie basis. Because many Republican leaders feared the political impact of an overly hasty return to gold, the Specie Payment Resumption Act of 1875 postponed resumption to January 1, 1879, slowly scaling back greenbacks in circulation. In signing the bill, Grant reiterated his belief that with a currency of fixed known value, business would revive and the beginning of prosperity on a firm basis would be reached. The act flew through Congress, encountering scant opposition. Republicans might disagree on Reconstruction, but they heartily concurred on preserving the perpetual strength of the almighty dollar. The midterm election results in autumn 1874 proved nothing short of calamitous for the Republican Party, a stunning repudiation of Grant and his inflation bill veto. Republicans relinquished their sizable majority in the House of Representatives, the first time they had surrendered control since the war, and Democrats took charge by a huge margin. This scarcely seemed the same Democratic Party trounced so handily by Grant 2 years earlier. It was small consolation to the Republicans that they retained a majority of Senate seats. The Democrats chalked up major triumphs in New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Missouri, and Illinois. The main reason for the electoral landslide was the economic slump, which left voters in a surly mood, and Grant's refusal to countenance a dose of inflation to conquer it. The aura of corruption around the White House had also contributed to a sense of an administration adrift. Some observers believed that speculation about a possible third term for Grant, something he dismissed in ridicule and contempt, made him seem selfish, encouraging disgruntled voters to turn against him. The first act of the new House would be to pass a resolution that exhorted Grant to refrain from seeking a third term, which would be unwise, unpatriotic, and fraught with peril to our free institutions. Another disaffected spectator was William T. Sherman, who was far less intimate with Grant than in the palmy days of their wartime comradeship. Sherman was irate when Grant allowed Secretary Belknap to interfere with his chain of command, and he moved his headquarters to St. Louis in protest. "My faith in Grant's friendship is shaken," Sherman told an editor, "and when again he wants it, it may be less than he supposes." Privately, Sherman was scathing about his old friend, pinning the electoral defeat on Grant. "General Grant and his immediate surroundings have been selfish and mean, and have alienated the country, and many of his old friends are not only alienated but deeply angry." He mentioned his many sacrifices for Grant. "You have seen how he has returned it. I am not sorry that he has caught the inevitable consequence." Sherman never understood that Grant had graduated from the narrow provincial outlook of a military commander to embrace a broader leadership role. Despite Sherman's bitterness, Ulysses and Julia Grant were the soul of hospitality when he lunched with them at the White House in November. In the congressional elections, Northern voters had sent a clarion message of retreat from black civil rights, protesting Grant's decision to send troops into Louisiana. Racism was omnipresent in the North as well as the South. "There is a deep and a growing restlessness and jealousy of military influence and ascendancy," Fish noted, "and this jealousy is being fostered by the Democratic press." As the Northern public, beset by economic troubles, soured on Reconstruction, they latched onto a book, The Prostrate State, South Carolina Under Negro Government, which portrayed Southern Reconstruction governments as populated by corrupt carpetbaggers and illiterate black legislators. The author, James Shepherd Pike, had worked for Greeley at the New York Tribune and become disillusioned with Grant. After Greeley died, his successor, Whitelaw Reed, sent Pike on a Southern tour which produced this racist diatribe. "Sambo takes naturally to stealing," Pike told readers. 7 years ago, these men were raising corn and cotton under the whip of the overseer. Today, they are raising points of order and questions of privilege." In this new dispensation, Grant was increasingly fair game. Democratic control of the House had far-reaching consequences for him. Armed with investigative powers, committees turned a glaring searchlight on executive departments to ferret out corruption, a tactic used to discredit the administration on Reconstruction. Half the House committee chairmanships were handed over to Southerners, who attempted to block further racial progress by Grant. In the South, Democrats regained control of Alabama as the old white elite restored their antebellum primacy. White and black Republicans in the region reacted with shocked dismay. "What sorry times have befallen us," wrote Adelbert Ames, now Mississippi's governor. "The old rebel spirit will not only revive, but it will make itself felt. It will roam over the land, thirsty for revenge. The war is not yet over." Through it all, Grant remained imperturbable. He had won battles precisely because he never succumbed to panic, but his congenital calm now made him seem out of touch to some colleagues. When Postmaster General Jewell dined at the White House, he didn't find the president as gloomy as he had expected, telling Fish that Grant had no appreciation of the results of the late election, which have been overwhelmingly adverse to the Republican Party. Other Republican leaders were equally alarmed, Vice President Wilson calling Grant the millstone around the neck of our party that would sink it. So despairing was Garfield that he felt all the gods had conspired to destroy the Republican Party, while Bristow interpreted the elections as a perfect Waterloo to Republicans. By late November, Grant labored several hours a day over his annual message to Congress, writing it, as usual, by himself. That August, when he attended a Methodist camp meeting at Martha's Vineyard, the mogul Russell Sage had invited him aboard an iron steamship built by his company. This encouraged Grant to revive a proposal he had floated a year earlier to connect American canals and rivers into a national network, lowering transport costs and stoking business. He also wanted to revive American shipbuilding, which had been badly damaged during the war, by paying ample compensation to American ships that carried mail domestically and abroad. Grant expanded this vision by again endorsing a canal to connect the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, and he had surveys conducted to locate the most feasible site. Quite visionary about this pathway, Grant maintained that it would add largely to the wealth of the Pacific coast and perhaps change the whole current of the trade of the world. As he struggled with his annual message, all issues paled beside the baffling subject of race relations. In a bluntly eloquent appeal, he reproached white Southerners for condoning vigilante violence against black citizens. He acknowledged that they fancied themselves law-abiding citizens. "But do they do right in ignoring the existence of violence and bloodshed in resistance to constituted authority?" He railed against those who denied federal responsibility to halt abuses on the state level. "The theory is even raised that there is to be no further interference on the part of the general government to protect citizens within a state where the state authorities fail to give protection. This is a great mistake. While I remain executive, all the laws of Congress and the provisions of the Constitution will be enforced with rigor." In short, Grant pleaded with white Southerners to do justice to blacks, or he would have no choice but to send in federal troops. He issued a prophetic warning of the perils facing America's two parties. Under existing conditions, the Negro votes the Republican ticket because he knows his friends are of that party. Many a good citizen votes the opposite, not because he agrees with the great principles of state which separate party, but because, generally, he is opposed to Negro rule. This is a most delusive cry. Treat the Negro as a citizen and a voter, as he is and must remain, and soon parties will be divided not on the color line, but on principle. From Southern Republicans, Grant heard heartrending pleas for help, a sorrowful chorus of concern. From a black minister in Tennessee, he learned of blacks flocking to his town because so many had been murdered by night riders elsewhere. He promised Grant that these colored people will all die for you today. They have a great love for you, so we want you to do all you can for us. A Houston resident complained of Democrats riding roughshod over Texas Republicans. Send your bayonets to Texas and break up the assemblage of maniacs, ruffians, and thieves at Austin. The writer asserted that Democrats wouldn't hesitate to make a constitution that placed the colored man in a peonage worse than slavery, but they fear the mighty Ulysses might break up their government. Unfortunately, Grant was progressively hamstrung in coping with this sudden rash of crises. The newly resurrected Democrats launched a congressional investigation into Justice Department spending that imposed steep cuts in enforcing Reconstruction. The three enforcement acts that had given muscle to the anti-Klan battle clashed with growing Southern resistance, bolstered by Northern neglect. Attorney General Williams, who had continued the crusading militants of Amos Ackerman against the Klan, faced growing hostility, and the press disparaged him as Grant's Secretary of State for Southern Affairs. He began to plead for more caution in Southern prosecutions, insisting the Klan had already been smashed. With major cases about Reconstruction's constitutionality pending before the Supreme Court, Williams instructed district attorneys that criminal prosecution under these acts ought to be suspended until it is known whether the Supreme Court will hold them constitutional or otherwise. When issued in spring 1876, those court decisions would slam the door shut on Reconstruction. The situation grew more perilous in March 1875, when Postmaster General Jewell asked Grant if he could speak to him plainly about a troubling matter. I always wish the cabinet to feel entirely free to make confidential communications to me, Grant replied. Jewell then told of whispers that the Judiciary Committee, probing the Justice Department, had generated facts about Attorney General Williams that could tarnish the administration. Williams's Supreme Court nomination had foundered in part because of his wife Kate's extravagant spending. Now it was alleged that after the Justice Department brought suit for evasion of customs duties against the New York merchant house of Pratt and Boyd, a certain lady had extorted $30,000 from them in exchange for a promise to drop the suit. When Grant conferred with Fish on April 12th, he preferred to view Williams as an innocent dupe, showing the sympathy for human frailty that was his tragic undoing. As Fish wrote, Grant had a high respect for Williams, but feared that he had been entrapped, or that transactions had passed through his hands without his notice, for which he could not fail to be held officially responsible, of a very disreputable nature. Nonetheless, frightened by a potential probe into the Attorney General's office, Grant suggested that Williams depart at once. In accepting his resignation, Grant gave no hint of the scandalous backdrop. My sincere friendship accompanies you in the new field of life you have chosen, and best wishes for your success. Very respectfully yours, U.S. Grant. In choosing a successor, Grant searched for someone of unimpeachable honesty to forestall further snooping by House Democrats. He picked Edwards Pierpont, a popular New York lawyer who had gained reformist credentials combating corruption in Tammany Hall. To avoid unpleasant surprises, Grant made sure to canvass his cabinet, all of whom warmly approved the choice. In adding Pierpont, Bristow, and Jewell to his cabinet, Grant temporarily silenced detractors who had portrayed his administration as riddled with corruption. Harper's Weekly said that by recruiting these three men of the highest character, Grant had shown his commitment to good government and honest administration. Perhaps no state exposed more graphically the irremediable clash between the Old South and Republican rule than Mississippi. The state legislature's composition was shockingly alien to many Mississippi whites. 55 of 115 state representatives were black, as were 9 of 37 senators. In the summer of 1874, Grant received a steady flow of warnings that white agitators operating under the People's Party or White Man's Party banner would attempt to purge the legislature by intimidating black voters and office holders. Especially alarming was violence predicted in Vicksburg, where armed whites prowled the streets before municipal elections on August 4th. On July 4th, the anniversary of Grant's Vicksburg victory, white thugs pounced on a patriotic celebration held by black Republicans and opened murderous fire on the crowd, with several killed in the subsequent melee. Peter Crosby, the first black county sheriff in Vicksburg, appealed to Lieutenant Governor Alexander K. Davis, who then pleaded with Grant to send two companies of U.S. soldiers. "Armed bodies of men are parading the streets both night and day," he informed Grant. Governor Ames grew desperately worried. Knowing only federal troops could safeguard black voters, he described for Grant the openly military character of the white Democrat threat, organized into infantry, cavalry, and artillery units. Departing from the assertive actions of his first term, Grant hesitated and refused to send in federal soldiers. "I have tried to get troops, but the president refuses," Ames told his wife. "It is thought he wants the support of the Southern Democrats for a third term. Most true it is that they are generally for him in this state, and they in Vicksburg who are rioting, who are ready for murder and frauds, laud him to the skies." The August election passed without violence. "The election just closed was the most peaceable and orderly ever held here," came the reassuring message to Grant from a Mississippi senator. But the eerie quiet merely proved that white intimidation had succeeded, with blacks terrorized into staying home. White supremacists expelled Republicans from local offices without firing a shot. "Had there been a doubt as to the issue," Ames concluded, "a bloody riot would have resulted." It was a turning point in Reconstruction, much as Vicksburg's fall had been during the war. White Democrats had demonstrated that without the protection of federal troops, they could resurrect the pre-war power structure. The Vicksburg vote showed the fundamental weakness of a political revolution that had relied heavily on force applied by outsiders in Washington, something that couldn't be maintained indefinitely. The lesson was well learned by armed White League and White Line militia in Mississippi, Louisiana, Arkansas, Alabama, and South Carolina, who mobilized to retake control of their states. Grant was peppered with conflicting reports from white Democrats and black Republicans in Mississippi, who seemed to reside on different planets. One white complained to Grant about ignorant, brutal black voters, griped that the scum of the North had flooded this country in pursuit of offices and plunder, and, referring to Grant himself, observed, "We have a dictator who claims to be president under the Constitution." Yet black citizens told Grant they felt utterly powerless. A black sergeant who had fought with Grant at Vicksburg said of the black community in Mississippi, "We are almost poverty-stricken to death. We are depending on you for help." The Democrats, he said, wanted to starve the damn Negroes out that vote the radical ticket. On December 5th, a bloodless coup occurred in Vicksburg when armed members of the Taxpayers League, the White League in some accounts, seized the Warren County courthouse, forced the black sheriff, Peter Crosby, to flee, then chased out the Board of Supervisors. As a column of black militia approached Vicksburg, the mayor declared martial law and appointed a former Confederate officer, Colonel Horace Miller, to enforce it. Black and white militia confronted each other at a bridge south of town. As blacks began to retreat, armed whites fired and killed several blacks. Whites then went on a homicidal spree, pulling blacks from their homes and killing them. Some violence occurred on the very spot where Pemberton had surrendered to Grant. "They were shot down like dogs," wrote Blanche Ames, the governor's wife, "and those that fell wounded were murdered." A congressional investigatory committee concurred. It was no battle, it was a simple massacre. The death toll approached that of a small battle, at least 21 blacks dead and 2 wounded. As one observer recalled, others were killed and eaten by buzzards. The birds had got all the meat off their bodies, and the only way you could recognize them was by their clothes. In the days ahead, armed white men initiated a campaign of killing in the nearby countryside that took up to 300 black lives. On December 17th, Governor Ames summoned the state legislature to an emotional special session. He now faced an armed uprising that he described as an insurrection in the fullest sense. Without the military means to curb this reign of terror, he feared the insurgents would impose a new order founded entirely upon the degradation and serfdom of a class. Both houses of the legislature endorsed a resolution calling upon Grant to hasten federal troops to Vicksburg. There was no way Grant could back down before a military putsch on American soil, and he now showed flashes of his gritty old panache. First, he acted to protect the Mississippi legislature, telling the federal commander in Jackson that if threatened with violence from unauthorized persons, they must be protected in the proper discharge of their duties. On December 21st, he issued a proclamation that repeated charges made by Ames and Mississippi legislators and ordered the disorderly and turbulent persons to disperse and retire peaceably within 5 days. Grant now followed the well-polished script of his first term. When Ames requested federal troops on January 4th, Grant promptly ordered his commanders to comply with the request of Governor Ames as far as practicable. His decisive response contrasted starkly with congressional wavering. "I fear that Congress will not give the president power to put down the white leaguers of the South," Jesse Ames told his son Adelbert. "If not, there can be nothing but a reign of terror in the South until the nation is involved in a civil war from one end of the land to the other, of which the last war is a mere trifle compared to it." When a congressional committee reported in February on the Mississippi bloodshed, it concluded that the nation had arrived at a crossroads and must either restrain by force these violent demonstrations by the bold, fierce spirits of the whites, or tell newly enfranchised black citizens, "We have made you men and citizens, now work out your own salvation as others have done." It had become flagrantly obvious that no common ground existed between the white and black communities in the South, no middle position that allowed for compromise. Any federal action would either inflame the white community or victimize the black. There was simply no neat solution as a violent gulf yawned open between Democrats and Republicans. The other Southern warfare that winter was in Louisiana, where blacks were terrified by marauding white leaguers. An attempt to integrate New Orleans schools resulted in a wave of violence as squadrons of white men and boys severely beat black students, hauling them forcibly from integrated schools and marching them off to black schools. "The city superintendent was attacked by a posse of half-grown boys and insulted, beaten, and even threatened with hanging," Grant heard from a student. Dismayed by the simultaneous violence in Louisiana and Mississippi, Grant sent Phil Sheridan to Vicksburg, Jackson, and New Orleans to collect information and report back on his findings. Sheridan's advent coincided with one of the stormiest moments in New Orleans annals. The 1874 election had created a stalemate in the Louisiana legislature. The conservatives, a fusion of Democrats and liberal Republicans, had ostensibly won the legislature, but the returning board, which certified elections, tried to forge a Republican majority by vacating several seats won by conservatives. The upshot was that when the lower house of the state legislature gathered in early January, both sides claimed to rule by a two-seat majority. Anticipating violence, 1,800 federal troops ringed the state house. At noon, with great turmoil in the chamber, the House convened, elected a conservative as the temporary speaker, and prepared to fill five undecided seats with conservatives. This prompted Republicans to march out in protest. What happened next shocked the nation. Governor William Pitt Kellogg requested that General Philippe R. de Troubrion remove all persons not returned as legal members of the House of Representatives by the returning board of the state. Accompanied by 20 bayonet-wielding soldiers, Troubrion burst into the chamber, brandishing papers from Governor Kellogg. One declared the House an illegal body, while another gave him authority to eject the five new members not confirmed by the returning board. The five conservatives were escorted from the chamber amid a show of bayonets and Republican cheers. By the time the general left, Kellogg Republicans controlled the disputed House, and conservatives had withdrawn, refusing to take dictation from federal soldiers. Sheridan was ready to hand out rough justice to white vigilantes. "I think that the terrorization now existing in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Arkansas could be entirely removed by the arrest and trial of the ringleaders of the Armed White League," he informed Belknap. "It is possible that if the president would issue a proclamation declaring them banditti, no further action need be taken except that which would devolve upon me." Sheridan's remarks became public, touching off a national furor. Without consulting Grant's cabinet, Belknap sent back a supportive telegram. "The president and all of us have full confidence and thoroughly approve your course." Sheridan's remarks and Belknap's response would haunt the administration. Not given to legal niceties, Sheridan told a visiting Massachusetts congressman that the best way to vanquish the White League was to suspend the, what do you call it, otherwise known as the writ of habeas corpus. In tampering with a legislature, the rambunctious Sheridan had crossed a line, hitherto invisible, that was now clearly marked out for irate citizens. His high-handed behavior was a publicity bonanza for Southern Democrats. The spectacle of soldiers entering a statehouse left Northern opinion aghast, leading to vociferous demands for Sheridan's ouster. Major Republican newspapers in the North denounced Grant. William Cullen Bryant thought it high time for Sheridan to tear off his epaulets and break his sword and fling the fragments into the Potomac. The strident headline in the New York World distilled Northern hysteria: "Tyranny! A sovereign state murdered!" The nation joined the apoplectic chorus, damning the New Orleans action as the most outrageous subversion of parliamentary government by military force yet attempted in this country. Before long, death threats against Grant, most emanating from the South, swamped the White House. The New Orleans events presented Grant with an issue as tough and intractable as any he had faced as president. He felt outraged at the injustices white Democrats perpetrated in Louisiana and Mississippi, yet even sympathetic Northerners cringed at the image of federal soldiers barging into a state legislature and ousting elected officials. George Templeton Strong spoke for many when he wrote, "I have stood up for Grant through evil report and good report for 10 years, but he would not condone the Louisiana blunder." A couple of days later, Strong ran into General John Dix, who remarked, "It's only the other day that they murdered a score or two of niggers at Vicksburg. Why didn't these gentlemen get up an indignation meeting about that?" Other isolated voices in the North roundly applauded the hard line in Louisiana, especially Wendell Phillips, who commended Grant's decision and sagacity in dealing with the White League. "One firm, decisive hour will scatter the whole conspiracy." Sensitive to public opinion, Grant worried about alienating supporters on whom he had relied to reform Southern society. On January 9th, he assembled his cabinet for a highly contentious debate on Louisiana. One of Grant's saving graces was his ability to listen, and he did just that. Attorney General Williams likened the federal troops in New Orleans to a posse comitatus, summoned to maintain peace under the U.S. Constitution, an interpretation Grant applauded. Fish protested that whether Democrats had committed fraud or not, Governor Kellogg had no right to interfere with the legislature. When he suggested that Grant repudiate Troublion's action, Grant snapped he would certainly not denounce it, nor would he censure Sheridan. But Fish thought Grant's support of Sheridan waned as the discussion progressed, and he seemed to be somewhat impressed with doubt as to the entire correctness of what had been done. The Louisiana hubbub did not subside. 2 days later, the Pennsylvania legislature passed a resolution condemning so heinous an abuse of the power committed to the president. At first, Grant refused to bend. Events in the South struck bedrock principles that he would not compromise. As he contemplated a message to the Senate, he told Fish he was determined under no circumstances to apologize for anything that had been done. Fish pleaded that a fundamental constitutional principle was at stake that the president had to defend. Grant replied that his message would recapitulate the events which he thought would show the necessity of what had occurred. In his speech sent to the Senate on January 13, 1875, Grant spoke straight from the heart. He summoned his innermost feelings from the war and frustration over the bloody punishment inflicted on Southern black and white Republicans, and his message rose to unusual heights of eloquence. Instead of restricting himself to recent Louisiana history, he reconstructed earlier outrages perpetrated in the state. He recounted the 6 Republicans murdered in cold blood in Cossati in August 1874, a crime that had gone unpunished. He recalled how D.B. Penn, who claimed election as lieutenant governor in 1872, issued an inflammatory proclamation calling upon state militia to drive from power their usurpers, as he termed Republican officeholders. The White Leagues, armed and ready for the conflict, promptly responded. Governor Kellogg had requested troops, and Grant had issued a proclamation to restore order. By then, insurgents had taken forcible possession of the state house and temporarily subverted the government. 20 or more people were killed, including a number of the police of the city. Grant implied that people had forgotten the bloody prelude to the violence inspired by Democrats, which had produced the legislative standoff. Turning to recent events in New Orleans, Grant pointed out that he hadn't known beforehand of Troublion's action, but he described a military coup hatched by conservatives who had employed fraud and violence to engineer a majority in Louisiana's lower house. "I am credibly informed that these violent proceedings were part of a premeditated plan to have the House organized in this way, recognize what has been called the McHenry Senate, then to depose Governor Kellogg and so revolutionize the state government." In conclusion, Grant expressed his extreme distaste at having to interfere in the domestic affairs of Louisiana. "I have deplored the necessity which seemed to make it my duty under the Constitution and laws to direct such interference." Nothing, he added, would afford him greater satisfaction than to sweep federal troops from the South. But he stated in tough, unsparing language that, "to the extent that Congress has conferred power upon me to prevent it, neither Ku Klux Klans, White Leagues, nor any other association using arms and violence to execute their unlawful purposes can be permitted in that way to govern any part of this country." Grant had refused to mince words about Democratic injustices in Louisiana. As Fred Grant told Sheridan, the Grant family had stood up for him, "and Mother carries her endorsement almost to an absurdity. Father is very strong in his feelings, but more quiet." That Julia Grant, erstwhile Southern Belle, felt so outraged by Democratic misbehavior in Louisiana, says something about the militant mood in the Grant household. From official Washington, Grant received welcome encomia on his address. "You have never been more forcible or felicitous in the presentation of a great public question," House Speaker Blaine assured him. John Singleton Mosby told Grant his message was a triumphant vindication of your conduct. At Faneuil Hall in Boston, a large protest meeting addressed by Wendell Phillips applauded Grant and Sheridan, but the national mood was swinging rapidly in the other direction. The president was running out of room to maneuver as the country backed away from further federal interference in the South. The outcry over Louisiana began to ring down the final curtain on Reconstruction. Southern whites increasingly substituted the word redemption, a restoration of white rule, for the hated term Reconstruction. In New Orleans, the atmosphere remained so combustible that newspapers openly advocated Sheridan's murder, and he was heckled when he appeared in his hotel dining room. "Some of the banditti made idle threats last night that they would assassinate me because I dared to tell the truth," he informed Belknap. "I am not afraid and will not be stopped. The very air has been impregnated with assassinations for some years." Grant refused to hurl Sheridan to the wolves and reiterated to two congressmen his high esteem for the diminutive general. "I believe General Sheridan has no superior as a general, either living or dead, and perhaps not an equal." When a congressional delegation went to Louisiana to collect evidence, Sheridan noted that more than 2,000 political murders had been committed in Louisiana since 1866. The congressman brokered a compromise whereby control of the lower house was returned to Democrats, who promised not to impeach or overthrow the Republican Governor Kellogg. Many saw the Louisiana violence as the opening shot of a second Civil War and a revitalized Confederacy, albeit clothed in a new form. Discussing the mood in New Orleans, Sheridan told Orville Babcock, "I have so often heard expressions that the new rebellion was to be fought under the stars and stripes, and in the North as well as the South, that the mistake made in 1861 was to have had their own flag." So darkly violent was the outlook that a former Georgia governor advised Babcock, "Confidential, the time has arrived when the president is in danger of assassination, and extraordinary caution should be exercised." As the whole edifice of Reconstruction cracked apart, fueled by a Northern backlash, those most fearful were the freed people of the South. Reflecting their anxiety, more than 200 Louisiana blacks petitioned Grant about their wish to emigrate to a foreign nation. "We cannot get upon a man's steamboat and make a round trip at what some of us are whipped, or beat, or killed, or driven ashore. If we stand up as men for the protection of our wives and our daughters, these white men says that we must die." One of the last hurrahs of Reconstruction was passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1875, enacted by lame duck Republicans. For several years, such a bill had been a will-o'-the-wisp for Charles Sumner, who hoped it would be the capstone of my work. As he lay dying in early 1874, he clasped the hands of visitors to his bedside and croaked passionately, "You must take care of the Civil Rights Bill. Don't let it fail." Despite its association with Sumner, Grant endorsed the measure and signed it into law on March 1, 1875. It outlawed racial segregation in public accommodations, schools, transportation, and juries. The law had many flaws in its enforcement provisions, but was revolutionary in its principles of equal treatment for all. "This bill is a simple declaration of the equality of the citizens of the United States," declared Harper's Weekly. Democratic governors never bothered to enforce it. Nonetheless, however toothless, it struck fear into those opposed to interracial justice, as evidenced by a new wave of death threats that Grant promptly received from the Klan. The Civil Rights Act of 1875 was struck down as unconstitutional by the Supreme Court in 1883. Not until 1957 would Congress dare to pass another civil rights bill, and it was only with the long-overdue Civil Rights Act of 1964 that many of the 1875 legislation's protections for blacks became the enduring law of the land.